This is the son of PCJ.
This is London. This is London.
The Voice of Russia World Service.
This is the Voice of America, Washington, D.C., signing on.
This is the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland, with a relay transmission via Bonaire in the Netherlands Antilles, directed from New Zealand.
This is Radio Prague, Czechoslovakia.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
Bonjour à vous si vous nous rejoignez sur Radio France Internationale. Il est 5h à Paris.
This is Radio Ukraine International.
This is the English program of Radio Deutsche Welle, Germany's international broadcasting service.
Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Paulette Macquarie and Keith Perron.
Hello and welcome to the monthly 55-minute edition of Media Network Plus. This month we have a special to coincide with the 25th anniversary of the SWL Winterfest that's taking place in Plymouth Meeting, Pennsylvania on March 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. Richard Cuff and John Figliozzi will be joining us on this special edition to look at the past and present of the SWL Winterfest. Media Network Plus, the show that awakens your mind. First, here's Keith with a look at some of the headlines from the world of media.
The Australian Broadcasting Corporation has engaged British consultants to conduct a major review of its daily TV, radio, and online news gathering operation. The director of ABC News, Kate Tony, said the British news consultant experts, Gary Rogers and Gay Flashman from Venture Consulting, had vast experience at the BBC, ITN, and Sky, and would spend time with staff in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, and Perth to get a sense of the workflow in various newsrooms and the different demands and pressures. Internet giant Yahoo has applied to be removed from a lodged lawsuit in an Indian court against social networking sites hosting allegedly offensive content. More than 20 internet firms, including Google and Facebook, have been named in the case, which follows meetings between government ministers and the companies over material seen as offending Muslims or defaming politicians. Telecoms Minister Kapil Sibal has pressured global internet firms to crack down on offensive material, but he has denied accusations of censorship, saying they only had to obey the same rules governing the press. Google and Facebook said earlier this month that they had removed allegedly offensive content used as evidence in court. The groups have appealed to the Delhi High Court asking the cases to be dropped on the basis they cannot be held responsible for their clients' actions. The International Telecommunications Union, or ITU, has called upon the world's nations to take necessary steps to stop intentional interference with satellite transmissions. The change in ITU regulations, which was approved at the just-concluded World Radio Communication Conference in Geneva, Switzerland, came after numerous complaints that international satellite TV programs in Persian and Arabic were suffering from deliberate interference, known as jamming. The two satellite operators that have been targeted, Eutelsat and Arabsat, said that the interfering signals originated from Iran and Syria. The interference, which has increased in September 2011, has infected broadcasts from the BBC, Radio France, France 24, Deutsche Welle, and others. Joining in the backing of the ITU rule change were Radio Netherlands Worldwide and the European Broadcasting Union. Community radio stations in Chile continue to call for the legal framework that would allow them to operate without restrictions, because although a specific law was passed nearly 2 years ago, it has not entered into effect. The new law expands the limit on broadcast power from 1 to 25 watts, the height of the station's antennas from 6 to 10 meters, but it only assigns 5% of the availability FM frequency for community stations. The last portion on the dial between 105.9 and 107.9. It also keeps a place-in ban on advertising. That means stations can only finance themselves by means of ads for businesses located within the station's range. While some see the new law as a step forward, others say it does not represent a significant improvement. The New Zealand government is being urged to lift a ban on Television New Zealand providing its free Pacific service to Fiji's first state television service. Fiji Broadcasting Corporation TV was launched by the interim Prime Minister, Frank Bananara, 3 months ago. The FBC says it made two requests to show TV New Zealand's Free Pacific service, but they were both turned down on instructions from New Zealand's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Jeff Robinson of Radio New Zealand has the details.
Fiji's new state television service wants the New Zealand government to lift a ban on Television New Zealand providing the station its Free Pacific service. The television service FBC TV was launched by Fiji's military ruler Frank Bainimarama in November last year. Since then, New Zealand's Ministry of Foreign Affairs has twice vetoed requests to rebroadcast TVNZ news and features. The Fiji Broadcasting Corporation's chief executive, Raiz Syed Kayum, says it's illogical to extend official sanctions against the military regime to television programs.
Personally, I think it's childish. They're a government. They can do whatever they like. They can make whatever decision they want to. I just don't think it's going to make any iota of a difference to the New Zealand government if they allow us to use the service or not. The only difference it will make is the fact that the public of Fiji will be able to see some great programs. That's all.
Well, our Pacific Issues correspondent, Karen Mangles, following the story. Karen, is it right that TVNZ has been told it cannot provide television programs to Fiji state television?
Yes, Jeff, it certainly appears so. I've spoken to both TVNZ and Foreign Affairs about this. TVNZ has confirmed it has declined an approach by Fiji State TV for rights to its Free Pacific service, but it won't comment any further. And the Ministry of Foreign Affairs says such a ban does fall under the New Zealand government sanctions that it imposed on Fiji's military regime after the coup back in 2006. And that means that TVNZ, because it's a state-owned broadcaster, cannot provide help to the Fiji Broadcasting Corporation because it too is owned by the Fiji government.
So why does Fiji state broadcaster think television should be exempted from the sanctions?
Well, it was an interesting interview that I had yesterday with Raiz Syed Kayum. He insists that it's a purely innocent request to TVNZ because FBC simply wants the best programs it can get for the least money, or in the case of the Pacific Service, for free. He says TVNZ's news and features like Tangata Pacifica and Asia Down Under are very relevant to Fiji's viewers, and more so than some of the other overseas programming it can get. And the Fiji viewers will be the ones who will suffer from a ban, not the Fiji military regime. And he says FBC TV, yes, it's owned by the Fiji government, but other than that, it's no different from the country's two other privately owned TV stations because it runs ads and commercial programming.
So does that mean that no TVNZ programs go to Fiji's television viewers at all?
No, it's not a blanket ban from what I've been told by Foreign Affairs. It's just one targeted at Fiji state television from New Zealand state television. And Fiji does have two privately owned commercial TV stations. They are both free to air, although one does also have a pay TV, and they do broadcast New Zealand programs. My TV, for example, carries TVNZ's Pacific service, and the other commercial network, which is Fiji TV, it has one of Fiji's top rating programs, which is Shortland Street, Jeff.
Well, there you go. Karen, thank you. Karen Mangle, our Pacific Affairs correspondent.
And that was Jeff Robinson of Radio New Zealand. If you would like more information on these and other stories, I invite you to visit the Media Network blog from Andy Sennett at Radio Netherlands Worldwide. You can find a link for them at www.pcjmedia.com. Look at the bottom of our page, click, and you'll be right there. I'm Keith Parent.
Call the PCJ answer line at country code 44203286. 1399. That's country code 44203286 1399, and leave your comments and questions. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is PCJ Radio.
Nearly 25 years ago, shortwave listeners in the U.S. gathered for the first SWL Winterfest in Culpsville, Pennsylvania, to discuss shortwave radio. Now, 25 years later, the festival has grown to not just include shortwave, but also other forms of communications. Things like ham radio, pirate radio, utility communications, scanners, and Wi-Fi radio. The festival grew from only a few people to now over 130 who annually show up. This year is expected to be particularly exciting, as it's now in its 25th year, a feat that I suspect the original organizers never thought would happen. On this special edition of Media Network Plus, we were joined by Richard Cuff and John Figliozzi, who have been the organizers of SWL Fest for a number of years, to talk about its past and present, and to discuss international broadcasting.
John and I have been coming since, I think, number four, and I guess we never really thought about it either necessarily reaching 25 or even reaching number six. It really seemed to be much more that, well, let's plan to do this again next year. And as long as the economics are favorable and the hotel cooperative, then we just kind of keep on participating. John and I have been mismanaging these affairs. I think, number 13 was our first. Or thereabouts.
Yeah.
Well, so, we kind of, at the end of each year, we ask ourselves, did we have fun? Yeah. Think we could make this work again? Yeah. All right, let's plan to have another one.
Yeah. So if you go back 25 years and you think about, let's say, the first one that you went to, and you compare it to, let's say, with what you have scheduled this year, what are some of the biggest changes?
I think our scope has widened. The idea of what radio is has expanded. The definition of radio has expanded to include a whole group of platforms that initially, it's called the Shortwave Listeners Festival, Shortwave Listeners Fest. So, that was the original focus and that was the original interest. But I think that if you look at our lineup this time, you'll see that there's much more in there, much more in there.
So give me an example, like what? I know what it is, but in case somebody listening right now doesn't know, what would you tell them?
Well, the most obvious one is internet radio, right, Rich?
It's one of the ways that we've kind of tried to sort of cast a wider net is that we look at other forms of communication, of getting content to audiences. Internet radio is one. We've got, for instance, some of the newer technologies such as software-defined radios. That's a whole category that didn't exist back in the days. We try to keep a mix together of equipment-oriented activities, programming-oriented activities. We do have several sessions that have I guess more of a nostalgic bent that we might have had in years past. So there are several different kind of threads out there, all of which nonetheless have to do with the fact that radio and audio programming really does set up the theater of the mind, that it's different than video and text. It's radio, and whether you get it out of a computer or a smartphone or an MP3 player or a shortwave radio, it nonetheless carries many of the same qualities nonetheless.
Something that I find rather amazing, we know about all the cuts that have been taking place. Recently, another station also disappeared from the airwaves, Radio Bulgaria. One thing that I find extraordinary, despite all these cuts, there are more shortwave radios on the market now and new ones coming out than there ever were.
Yeah, I think that, certainly there's more being made, but I think there's a certain kind, certain kind of radio coming out now. There are more, what you would call consumer grade radios. If you look at the lists of what, for example, a prominent mail order house like Universal Radio, which has been around for years and years, you would have seen a lot more communications receivers, a lot more radios that looked a lot like they were more professional instruments or semi-professional instruments than today. Now you see things that look like radios and sell for, you know, maybe $100, give or take. And I don't know what that necessarily means. It probably means, since most of these radios are coming out of China, that the Chinese market for shortwave radios is still very, very healthy. But I'm wondering if they're selling that many shortwave radios in this country than what they were maybe back even, you know, 10 years ago.
You see,
yeah, I think I would support that observation.
You see, the thing that I find quite interesting, in throughout Southeast Asia, in Indonesia, Sri Lanka, India, you will find a lot of shops that will have shortwave receivers, but they don't sell communications receivers. They sell the average shortwave receiver that anybody can use to listen to overseas broadcasts. Do you think that's because the audience or the shortwave listening audience in North America is so different from, let's say, Southeast Asia or Africa or the Pacific?
Well, I think very much so. I think that's very much the case, that shortwave fills a much different role for audiences in these areas than it does in North America. I think, as I said earlier on, you know, shortwave radio in North America has been a specialized activity for decades. And while many North American shortwave enthusiasts have some portable receivers, those same people probably have upwards of three or four radios to their name, including one or more of the higher end communications receivers. So it's just a different type of activity conducted for a different purpose.
Yeah, well, radio is never a domestic medium here, really, you know, all that much. I mean, if you look even now, you look at the list of stations out there, you know, those countries that you're talking about are, you know, use it for domestic communications, for domestic radio. In many cases, because people are, you know, they're, you know, China, of course, is a huge country, a lot of rural areas far away from, you know, urban locations. So it lends itself still to that use. In this country, it's, as Rich said, I agree, it's been mostly a specialized use in this country. And the people that embraced it here were people that had a unusual interest in what was going on overseas, either because they came from there and were trying to stay in touch with their home countries, or because the, you know, academics that are interested, or people that just have you know, an interest beyond the norm, if you want to call it that, or beyond the average of what was going on overseas. So it's a different audience entirely.
You know, not too long ago, I was talking with a chap in Hong Kong. He works for a major international advertising agency. He's also an SWL. And he said to me the biggest problem, he said, that shortwave has had, let's say, in parts of Western Europe and North America, he said, was marketing. They didn't market it to be cool and hip.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's some truth to that. But I'm not sure that the difference here was marketing. I mean, I just think that, you know, the medium, I mean, you go back to the 30s and 40s, you had an AM, you know, sophisticated radios, let's put it that way, had AM band and a shortwave band. And then FM came about, and all of a sudden shortwave bands began to disappear from radios here. You know, it just didn't sound as good as FM. And, you know, we have a cornucopia of media here, you know, in North America. And I'm not sure that even if you marketed shortwave, you would have gotten the kind of, you know, you probably would have done better, but I'm not so sure that would have made the difference.
You know, you have to remember as well that the last domestic shortwave radio station in the United States that was targeting a domestic audience would be targeting domestic audience would have been the 1930s. You sort of put an asterisk on that and look at WNYW from roughly the 1960s. You know, and that's really been the time when there was a classic domestic shortwave radio broadcaster in the U.S.
I find it quite extraordinary when I will discuss, occasionally even last year, there was a hearing into the cuts at the BBC, a British parliamentary hearing into it. And I submitted my own thoughts, which they used, and they even called me up to get some more comments. And I was very surprised to hear from certain government officials, oh, nobody listens to shortwave in China. And I said to them, I said, well, how can you say that? They said, oh, we went on a fact-finding tour for 2 weeks. As soon as they said that, I asked them, were you accompanied by government, Chinese government officials? And they said, yes. I said, well, why don't you go independently, talk to people independently when there are no Chinese government officials around and see what they say? I mean, I've seen this myself during the Sichuan earthquake in 2008. I was in Sichuan and I was talking to people about listening to international radio, and they said, oh, our radio can't work right now because we have no electricity. And all of a sudden, some Chinese government officials came by and they changed their story. In China, for example, the way they market shortwave is quite interesting because they jam broadcasters. You know, they love jamming. That's what their favorite pastime. But yet at the same time, I mean, if you pick up newspapers in Beijing, Shanghai, and other parts of China, the way they market shortwave radio is quite interesting because they market it as a way. I mean, this is what I find odd. They say, oh, yes, you can listen to the world on this radio and you can practice your foreign languages and you can listen to news abroad. But I'm like, yeah, but you jam everybody. I mean, it's sort of silly, you know?
Yeah, that's true. But there is sort of a divide there. I mean, there's, you know, I mean, China, well, you know, we could go into a long discussion on this, but China's an interesting place because you're obviously much closer to it and have been there. I've never been there, but from what my perception at a distance, still a rather tightly controlled governmental structure, trying to maintain its hold on society, but an economy that more resembles, almost a runaway capitalist economy, you know, with few regulations in the sense that. As far as labor regulations go and things along that line, pretty freewheeling. So if you're marketing a radio, you know, it's sort of like here in some ways too. You market something and it doesn't necessarily mean you can do that with the device that you're marketing, but it has the capability. So you emphasize that in order to increase your sales. But when you were talking about marketing, I thought, Keith, you were talking about marketing it here. And, certainly you can see a difference between the way it's marketed in other countries and marketed here. But I think that's simply because the perception of the market is different, and I think properly so.
You know, here in Taiwan, which has a very small shortwave audience, it even did when Taiwan was under martial law. Last year, Costco, which they have many in the United States and in other countries as well, started carrying three shortwave models. They're now carrying six. And I asked the buyer for the Taiwan region. I said, why? He said, well, the Taiwan government last year asked us if we can carry because for their emergency broadcast system, because we get hit by typhoons, major earthquakes, and that's the only reason why they started carrying it. And they had these bundle deals, which is quite fascinating. If you bought one particular model, you would also get a solar panel to power the radio.
Whereas around here, I mean, you see these disaster radios or these emergency radios. Some have shortwave bands, some don't. Mm-hmm. But as John said, yeah, shortwave is different here, and in some ways, it's one of the things that makes shortwave radio so is that it is a global activity in that transmissions don't know national boundaries. However, the markets and the way the audiences use radio differ quite a bit.
Do you think that, for example, in the United States, there are a lot of listeners who maybe stations don't know about because they're people that say never write?
Oh, I'm sure there have been over the years. It's of course we have this term that I believe and a former president Richard Nixon had used back in the 1960s, 70s called the silent majority. And I'm sure that there are a fair number of people out there who have just been silent consumers over the years. It's getting awful tough, though, to be one of those in North America because the number of stations that target North America has dropped so much. There are probably now, 20 to 30 broadcasters at most that maintain an English language service that is relatively easy to hear in North America, and that's it.
And they're all and they're all China Radio International, right?
Yeah. And most certainly the most reliable signal on most times of the day is CRI broadcasting either via Albania, Cuba, or Canada, or other relay transmitters. So, you know, there's less to hear out there, so you wonder if a lot of folks that considered themselves casual listeners over the years have wound up having to just give up because the stuff they used to listen to is gone.
Yeah, you see, in my part of the world, it's funny. I mean, I've been living in Asia now for almost 11 years, and when I tune in, just before we recorded this interview, I was listening to Radio Australia, and I usually listen every day when I wake up. And listening here reminds me of what it was like listening in Canada over 20 years ago, you know. And stations here, I mean, one of the clearest ones, it was funny. I was having this discussion with Nigel Holmes, the frequency manager of Radio Australia. And I said to him, with the cuts the BBC made to some of their transmissions to Asia, does that bother you? He says, no way. He said, it's the best thing for us. It just means we now have taken over their audience. And Radio Australia has been adding frequencies to the Asia Pacific.
Yeah. And they've, you know, if you look at look at how they've evolved over the past 10 to 15 years, they have turned their sights more on Asia than they had before. It used to be much more a Pacific targeted service almost exclusively, it would seem. And you see a lot more material that they're producing and programs that they're producing that target an Asian audience as well, no doubt.
Yeah, in some ways, this is good. I mean, you know, if you're a listener here and, you know, you have the equipment, and many of us do, you know, this is sort of a good time, too, because, I mean, I'm finding, especially now that the sunspots have started to come up a little bit again, which is another factor that, you know, we could talk about. But since, you know, the ionosphere is starting to fire up a little bit, I mean, I'm finding myself, because there's a lot of stuff that's no longer there anymore blocking it, I'm hearing things that are targeted to other areas of the world, you know, and hearing them quite well, you know, obviously with an external antenna and with better equipment. But, you know, as far as, you know, the other part of the discussion goes, you got to remember that this, I mean, historically is a country that's far away from other foreign shores. So it's always felt itself somewhat apart and isolated, you know, away from, and there's always an isolationist bent here. But I was listening to an interview tonight with Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was the national security advisor during the Carter administration, just wrote a book. And he pointed out that Americans, you know, and it's not good for us, but that Americans are pretty, you know, as a rule, or as a people, are pretty ignorant about the rest of the world. True. And not all that interested, which is not a good thing for us. But, you know, that also is reflected in, you know, interest in things like shortwave or even in the ability on the internet now to tune in, you know, overseas stations. I would venture a guess that any people that use internet for radio here either listen to domestic stations or do a Pandora kind of use. They're not necessarily tuning into, you know, Radio Sweden's half-hour broadcast in English or, you know, Radio Taiwan International's, you know, daily broadcasts.
It really depends on what are the motivations that drive the listener. I have a college-age daughter who is has had a steady boyfriend who lives in Kazakhstan. My daughter has traveled to Kazakhstan twice now over the past 2 years. This gentleman is originally from Russia, and so my daughter now pretty much tunes into the Voice of Russia almost every day in English, but she does so on her smartphone. You know, and it was just the natural way for her to connect with the Voice of Russia was over TuneIn smartphone, Android smartphone app on an Android smartphone.
But she also has something else, Rich, that a lot of other kids don't have, and that was a father with an interest in this, you know, in international radio, that she certainly was aware of, too.
Yeah, and this is true. Well, we all have a lot of fun there, I guess.
You know, one of the things I do find that is quite interesting nowadays, you know, we're talking about listening to international programming. I mean, there was a time when, if you wanted to listen, you had to listen. You had to listen at this specific time on this specific frequency, and you either had to be home to do it or had a small portable radio with no obstructions around to listen. Yep. And I find it interesting today that, for example, if I'm traveling in Taipei on the subway, or I'm on a bus somewhere, or I'm in the park taking my dogs for a walk, or I'm even shopping in Costco, I can punch up the BBC or Voice of America and listen on a phone app. I mean, that is just incredible.
It really has led to an interesting phenomenon that because everything is available now, or most everything is available on demand, we've in some instances gotten lazy because we tend to listen to the same stuff over and over again, or the same programs, because we like them. It used to be, like you say, you listen to whatever was on at a particular point in time. Some of what you listen to, you would make an appointment to do so. For instance, my Thursday evenings in North America, and John's were too, probably for decades, revolved around Radio Netherlands and Media Network with Jonathan Marks. And you made sure you were somewhere near your radio Thursday nights at local time, depending on whether it was winter or summer. And you arranged your schedule around that. You know, nowadays, you don't have to. It's just a matter of, okay, I've got time. What do I want to listen to now? And so you're not subject to the whims of the schedule makers or propagation into the choice of half a dozen stations that might be on at any particular hour. It's all on. It's all on anytime. And so I have to force myself to listen to a variety of broadcasters and broadcasts. Otherwise, I'd be just lazy and listen to the BBC with NewsHour or As It Happens on the CBC or my other favorite programs.
And you're listening to a special edition of the monthly edition of Media Network Plus, looking back at 25 years of the SWL Winter Fest. We'll be right back with more.
You can hear PCJ Radio while on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher is a free news, talk, and entertainment mobile app available for your smartphone. Downloading is quick and easy. Just find Stitcher from the App Store. Then, during registration, hit the promo code box and enter PCJ to get automatically entered to win $100. For more information, go to www.pcjmedia.com and click on the Stitcher logo on the right menu. PCJ Radio on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio.
We now continue our conversation with Richard Cuff and John Figliozzi, the organizers of the SWL Winter Fest, taking place this year on March 1st, 2nd, and 3rd in Plymouth Meeting, Pennsylvania.
You know, here's an interesting area that I want to go into. I mean, recently, Radio Bulgaria abruptly stopped their English transmissions on shortwave. I mean, well, they stopped all shortwave, period. I was talking with this about with someone who was working at Radio New Zealand, which also Radio New Zealand mainly targets the Pacific and parts of Asia. And my feeling was, you know, a station like Radio Bulgaria and some of the other ones that went, have they lost their relevance? Because first of all, they usually have maybe a half hour transmission. They only focus, let's say, on Bulgaria, and the audiences that they're targeting, which Radio Bulgaria mainly targeted only Europe and North America, the information on Bulgaria is already available online. Do you see that happening? I mean, for example, let's say Radio Sweden and others. It seems that the smaller stations haven't really fared as well. And he said to me, he said, you know, if Radio Bulgaria had, let's say, targeted programming, a program targeting Africa that was in that had to deal with, say, Bulgarian African issues or Bulgarian Asia Pacific issues, they probably would have fared a lot better.
Yeah, I mean, I think from a programming standpoint, A lot of these stations, you know, they tried to adapt, though maybe a little too late. And then when they tried to do it, they didn't do a great job at it. I see that still being tried, for example, with Radio Romania. They're still working at it. But I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think that there was not an understanding of looking at this from the audience's point of view and what kind of how would they like to receive the information. I think that was the genius behind Radio Netherlands for so many years, is that the people that were running Radio Netherlands understood the medium of radio, understood their audience probably better than anyone, any other station out there, with the possible exception of the BBC, and did an excellent job tailoring programs that listeners wanted to hear. And that's reflected even today, when many of their programs, they've made arrangements with NPR in the United States and CBC in Canada, and some of their programming shows up there even today, even in their budgetary challenge state that they're in now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason why I say that, for example, like when I listen to the VOA in the evening, in the morning they have their 1 hour transmission, which mainly targets on just U.S. domestic news. But then in the evening hours, they focus on the U.S. relationship with Southeast Asia and the Asia Pacific, and reporting on news that in some countries in Asia, they won't even report on. They really cater to the audience. The BBC World Service do the same. Radio France International, their French service and English service. Radio Australia, Radio New Zealand. But then, for example, when I tune occasionally, let's say, to Radio Canada International, when I can pick them up, a guy in Indonesia said to me, why would I listen to RCI's 1 hour, which they only focus on stuff that I really have no interest in, about some murder case that happened in Toronto. I want to find out what's going on here in Indonesia and Canada's relationship with Indonesia.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, the motivations of stations have always kind of depended in part on where stations felt their role as being in the whole galaxy of media. I mean, you do have to, in some instances, kind of take the year 1991 and look at the role of shortwave radio stations before the fall of the former Soviet Union and then after, because the great ideological battles that were prevalent before 1991 really motivated a lot of what you heard on the radio. Since 1991, many stations had gradually had the relevance question. I mean, some disappeared relatively early on, like Radio Norway, Radio Finland. For others, they've disappeared more recently. But you know, it's what does a station see as its role in either telling the world about what's going on in its home country, or trying to make connections between the home country and the audience in the target country, or telling news about a target region that the domestic sources couldn't or wouldn't provide. So all of these represent different roles that these broadcasters have played and can play, and in some instances these roles face challenges now, because, like you say, if I'm really that interested in what's going on in Bulgaria, a few clicks of my mouse and the use of a search engine or two, I can get what's going on out there relatively quickly.
Right. I mean, you said that, you know, we've seen a lot of changes since 1991 after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the wall coming down, but yet there's still other regions of the world. I mean, let's take China, for example. You would think that after all of this, they would have redirected it from the Soviet Union to China.
They have. I mean, we have one broadcaster that's coming, you know, to the fest, to bring this around full circle, Radio Free Asia, that's totally focused. Well, it's not totally focused on China, but it's certainly a major part of its focus is China, and it didn't even exist in 1991.
Right, but I'm also, let's say, talking about, you know, not just China, but also China's neighbors. I mean, let's say like VOA, the way they would target the Soviet Union, or the BBC, the way they would target the Soviet Union. It seems that now, they're not doing that. They're taking a much softer line and sort of either cutting back on frequencies, which, of course, the Chinese love.
Yeah, but they're doing it a different way, Keith. They're doing it in a different way. They're either they're targeting them with media that they perceive, at least, is more in use than shortwave now these days. Now, you know, we can argue over whether that's, or you know, we can discuss over whether that's a wise choice that they've made. But I don't think they've necessarily throttled back the effort. I think they've refocused it.
You know, the last time I was in China, I opened up the BBC app and the VOA app on my iPhone. In Shanghai, they don't work. It's like, you know, the gatekeeper effect, you know. And
sure.
and recently, like, for example, like with Iran, Iran has started to make an internal internet system. And people in Iran have been saying that the internet has been getting slower and slower and slower, especially for international sites. And China has been doing the same, but in a very different way. So I kind of wonder then, well, what are these people thinking that are making these decisions?
I think one of the things that the VOA has done is to invest quite a bit in internet technologies that enable folks to use proxy servers and alternate sources to try to keep one step ahead of the gatekeepers. And they've been reasonably successful, from what I understand, in doing so, but they recognize that they have to do more than just produce programming and get it out over the airwaves. They've got to find a way to use technologies that enable their audience to bypass the censors and gatekeepers. So the VOA has put a lot of effort into doing this that those of us living in North America wouldn't necessarily grasp, or those in other countries with unrestricted media wouldn't have a sense that that's part of what the VOA does.
Having said that, though, I mean, let me add to that, that, I mean, there is a valid point to be made that many of these stations have gone away from shortwave much too quickly, especially for certain areas of the world where that would be a more effective that could arguably be a more effective technology in getting through interdiction efforts like jamming and other efforts. So you know, I think that, you know, that there are people out there that are making that argument, and I think they have a point that should be heard, at least. And but unfortunately, I think in many cases, decisions are made not necessarily based on what's going on somewhere else, but they're made on the basis of what's going on, you know, at the originating country. And there's a little bit of a lack of understanding that maybe the rest of the world is not quite there yet.
So let me ask you this then. I mean, we've seen, for example, China Radio International increasing their shortwave transmissions, increasing their programming output. 10 years ago, they were not even in the top 10 of program content providers. Now they're in the top 5. There seems to be this lack of awareness that China's really doing this. Because wait a second, if China's adding all these frequencies and they're getting the money to do it, don't tell me that the VOA and the U.S. and British governments can't afford it.
Well, my perception is that China has something that the rest of these countries don't have, and that is budgetary pressures. And I don't necessarily think that I don't necessarily think they have a lot of listeners on shortwave in the United States. I mean, they are also expanding their outlets to some degree in some areas to medium wave and FM. Some local placement, I think, in Houston, Philadelphia, I think. Rich probably could speak to that. Yep. There's a station in Philly that carries some of their broadcast. Washington, D.C., Toronto, CHIN, actually, in Toronto, carries a bunch of CRI. And they probably have better success reaching listeners, you know, that way than they probably do with shortwave. But I think they're spending a lot of money that probably is not producing any results for them, but the money is not an issue for them.
You know, here in Taiwan, Radio Taiwan International, which is not far from where I am, I said, are you going to continue with shortwave to North America? And they said, well, for us, we have to, because if China's there, we have to stay there. But they tell me at the same time, if China drops North America, we're going to drop North America.
That's the Cold War mentality,
yeah.
Right? I mean, as long as Moscow was pumping in any number of kilowatts into megawatts into the United States, the United States was going to go in the other direction. I mean, it was a self perpetuating philosophy that was going on there. And once the Berlin Wall came down and that philosophy collapsed, all of a sudden people were asking, well, what are you doing? You know, where is all this money going? Why are we doing this? And, you know, you see the results now.
Mm-hmm. John, let's talk about your book, The Worldwide Listening Guide, the fifth edition.
Okay.
I was going through this, and I have it right in front of me right now, and despite the fact there are less English broadcasts targeting North America, there's still a lot to listen to. When I'm going through this, it is amazing. Okay, maybe you're picking up a transmission meant for another part of the world. You have to change the way you listen. Maybe you can't listen in the evenings as much anymore, but there's still a lot out there.
Yeah, I mean, the book tries to be platform agnostic. I mean, it's, you know, it had its beginnings. The whole concept had its beginnings as a shortwave listening guide because there just weren't any program guides really out there, amalgamated program guides, consolidated program guides for shortwave listening. You could get a great, you know, program book from the BBC at one time and from individual stations. And really the attempt was just simply to try to put these things together. But what has happened obviously is that the platforms for radio have expanded greatly, something we mentioned earlier on in our discussion on the Winterfest and how the Winterfest has changed, and that's how this book has changed as well.
Did you compile this yourself? Because I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, wow. I mean, how much work went into this?
I have no social life whatsoever. I just sit by the computer and enter these things in the computer. It is a labor of love. It is something that, and fortunately, my family, it gives me great indulgence to lock myself, you know, in here for hours at a time and do it. But I enjoy doing it. It's something that enjoy doing, understanding how stations put together their overall presentation, whether it's a BBC Radio 4 and what the idea is behind that, to, you know, why are the particular topics covered in a 1-hour broadcast on Radio Romania International. It's just something that's always fascinated me, and it allows me to sort of express that interest and share it with other people. But it is something that I have to do myself because there's nothing else out there that makes this, something like that, available, at least not in book form.
Now, if somebody wants to get a book, how is the easiest way to obtain it?
Well, if you're in the United States, you can order it from Universal Radio, or you can get it from Amazon.com. In fact, you get that worldwide as long as it's the Amazon USA site. Click in the name of the book and it'll come up. We are trying to grow some outlets with it. We've been talking with Radio Shack, which is still a big player in this country, at least as far as electronic stores are concerned. There's probably more of them than there are of any other even Best Buy or something along that line. So we're talking to try to increase its availability. But, basically right now it's available through hobbyist stores, like I said, an online or a mail order house like Universal Shortwave, and then through Amazon.
This is PCJ Radio on 88.2 FM. This is PCJ Radio on 107.5 FM in Nairobi, Kenya. And nationwide on 5. This is PCJ Radio on KBCT in Waco, Texas. This is PCJ Radio on 99.55 kilohertz to Latin America. This is PCJ Radio on 7590 kilohertz DRM. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is PCJ Radio.
This is Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio. If you have any comments or questions, please write to us at mnp@pcjmedia.com. Again, that's mnp@pcjmedia.com. And if you'd like to listen to any past editions, go to www.pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus, all one word. You'll also find information there on broadcast times of the weekly 30-minute edition via the World Radio Network, Sirius XM, Shortwave, and through our partner stations. Now time for next week's propagation forecast. Here's Dan Hensley.
A 10.7 centimeter flux of 105 from February 25th to February 27th, 2012. On February 28th through March 2nd, 2012, a 10.7 centimeter flux of 100 even. On February 25th, we'll see an A index of 8. And then an A index of 5 from February 26th to March 1st, 2012. On March 2nd, we'll see a rising A index to 8. The KP index will be 3 on February 25th, followed by a KP index of 2 from February 26th to March 1st. On March 2nd, the KP index will be 3. Looks like good propagation this week, though the A index is high on February 25th and March 2nd, and moderately high from February 26th to March 1st. Look for the KP index and 10.7 centimeter flux to help us out on the bands a bit. On February 22nd, the sunspot groups were in view. 1419, 1420, and 1422. On February 21st, a partial eclipse of the sun occurred. According to spaceweather.com, during the eclipse, the edge of the moon briefly covered sunspot AR1422, a source of strong ultraviolet emissions. SDO's EVE sensor, which measures the sun's extreme UV output, saw a sharp drop at several wavelengths when the sunspot was behind the moon. This was a rare opportunity for solar and radio propagation researchers at NASA.
And with that, we've come to the end of this month's edition of Media Network Plus. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you enjoyed the show. We always love feedback from our listeners, so contact us anytime at mnp@pcjmedia.com. Once again, mnp@pcjmedia.com. Also, a reminder that you can now listen to the show on your smartphone and other mobile devices. Just go to www.pcjmedia.com and click on the link to the Stitcher app, which you can download absolutely free. So on behalf of the whole team, I'm Paulette McCrory in Vancouver, Canada, saying so long. See you again soon.